Parliament is back for 2 weeks. It's the first time in over 6 weeks, and a lot has happened. We've had the submarine decision. Christian Porter was torpedoed. But it seems the focus is on the nuts in the gnats. Time for Laura Tingle. Welcome back, Laura.
Thank you, Philip. The nuts in the gnats. No, look, you've got the you've always had the sort of the gist of the slogan there.
I donate it freely and happily, but it really is extraordinary, isn't it, that we have a government, a nation held to ransom.
Oh well, absolutely. But Philip, you have to understand that according to the Nats, they are the ones being held to ransom. The world is even stranger than you think.
But and the poor darlings have only had a couple of hours to consider the issue.
Somebody did some calculation which involved 8,000 hours or something, but, they've only had 4 hours to think about it, Philip.
Is it tenable to have a Prime Minister who cannot, in fact, take a sane policy overwhelmingly supported by the population and by most other industrial leaders, can't take that to Glasgow?
Look, one can contest whether it's supported or not, Philip, but what I find much more difficult to contest is whether a Prime Minister should actually have a policy. And we have got a Prime Minister who doesn't have a policy on climate change. Everybody keeps talking about whether the Nats have a policy on climate change. Well, what's the Prime Minister's policy on climate change? It's a dancing between the raindrops policy, which is, I don't have a policy that is going to offend anybody. I don't have a policy that's about what Labor says. I don't have a policy about what the Nationals say. I've done these, dare one say, smart ass stunts with lumps of coal in the parliament, about electric vehicles at the last election, which was just such a stunt that, it's been abandoned ever since. Call me old-fashioned, Philip, but, I remember the days when the idea was that a Prime Minister would have a policy. He'd say, OK, guys, this is what we're going to do. He'd push it through his cabinet, he'd push it through his party room and through the parliament if necessary, and ultimately he would advocate it to the general populace and say, look, like it or get rid of me, whatever. But that's what I think in the national interest we should do, and we do not have that at the moment.
But, of course, he's not the first Prime Minister to be, in a bit of difficulty. It's been the issue that has destroyed a few of his predecessors.
Well, it has destroyed a few of his predecessors, but they've had a go, Philip. They've had a go, and then they've been done over one way or another, either by their side or by the opposite side of politics. But they've had a go. This guy has not had a go.
He's confirmed that he won't be lifting the 2030 target, but he will be arguing that Australia will be meeting and beating it. God, I hate these phrases.
Yep. So, essentially, he's now decided he is going to go to Glasgow to the climate change summit, and he said that, there are two issues here. One of them is what we do between now and 2030, and the second issue is what we do between now and 2050. Now, until about 12 months ago, the issue was about getting to net zero emissions reduction by 2050, which didn't mean that you wouldn't have any more emissions, but it would mean that you'd be having these offsetting measures. But in the last 12 months, all these radical communist countries like, well, the UK, the United States have all been saying, actually, we're going to cut our emissions between now and 2030. And it's not because they're going to close down industries, but it's because electric vehicles are becoming a big thing. It's because the international investment community is saying, actually, coal is not a great investment. We're going to sort of start to decarbonise. It's the fact that big companies like BHP are saying, we're going to decarbonise. We're going to just focus on things like rare earth and things like that. You know, all of these things have been happening, and
well,
our
we've
government
also,
has not...
we've also had a sort of a born-again Christianity thing in Rupert.
Well, yeah, but sorry if I'm sort of cynical about that one, but you know, there are the dollars, Philip, which have obviously influenced Rupert, as you say, because his advertisers are there as well. You know, all of it has been swinging towards the fact that people see stranded assets, as they call them, in old coal developments. Yes, coal will be with us in terms of a power generation source for some years to come, but it is on the decline. You know, I mean, this is not a philosophical position, a political position, a communist position. It's the markets, you know, who are the ultimate god in the eyes of the coalition. They are all saying, nah, this isn't going to work anymore. You know, the world is moving against these things. So...
Okay, let's swing the spotlight elsewhere. Morrison has been dubbed the Prime Minister for New South Wales, and Dominic Perrottet is earning the reputation for Premier of Australia.
Well, not necessarily in a good way, but well, this is true. I mean, it's interesting, Philip. We've got this sort of weird position where there is this, the pandemic has sort of reflected on and shown up the actual relationship of power and influence between the federal and state governments. And a couple of weeks ago, the Prime Minister came out and said, oh, we're going to open the international borders and, you know, we're going to really, force the states to, you know, stop, you know, having closed borders and was really trying to pressure the states to open up. And then Gladys Berejiklian hit the dust and Dominic Perrottet took over and announced last Friday that New South Wales was going to open the borders from November the 1st to everybody without quarantine of any description. And then Scott Morrison caught a little bit on the hop, just as all the states had been when he'd announced that he was going to open the international borders, had to come out and say, well, actually... You know, we do control some of this stuff. Now, what is the reality of all of this? The reality is that, in fact, it turns out that the federal government, having ceded responsibility for quarantine, which is its one constitutional responsibility, to the states last year, doesn't have all that much control about what happens from here on in. Essentially, the states can say, by saying, well, we will accept people who have not been quarantined, and we will not, and we will remove the caps on the number of people coming into Australia. That is the sort of really dominant factor in who comes into Australia. Now, the only point of difference is that Dominic Perrottet was a little bit vague about this in the sense that he was saying, well, everybody can come in, but the priority will be for Australian citizens. Now, Scott Morrison came out subsequently and said through slightly gritted teeth, well, you know, it's up to us who gets visas to come in. So he's saying, you know, the priority will be for Australian citizens coming home, and it will be up to us to decide how many tourists and international students and people seeking working visas come in. All, you know, all of these propositions are true, but it has shown up the weakness of the federal government's position in actually controlling what happens with our management of the pandemic from here on in, because it was very easy for the federal government, which has basically given up its capacity to run government services, to hand over all of these responsibilities to the states. And having done so, it's basically left them to call the shots on a whole range of issues associated with this.
I've been rereading a column by a certain prominent journalist printed in the Fin Review recently. And it asks the rhetorical question, can you think of a more abject failure of political leadership in living memory? Now, that's
that's a big call.
It is a big call. But it takes us back to the question, can you remember a time when the Nats and the Liberals were at war to this extent?
I think the Batuta advocate actually... had a rather sardonic version of this, which was about the last time they had such a big brawl, Philip, was when the Liberals tried to stop the Nationals having sex with their staff. But that's, you know, that's probably a bit flippant. Look, there have been a whole range of issues on which there have been differences between the Libs and the Nats. I think the important thing about this particular brawl is that I think the Nationals are fighting for their political lives as a separate force from the Liberals. They don't have, well, you know, they've brought Barnaby Joyce back as a sort of a point of differentiation. Somebody once said to me that the Nationals thrive either on the coattails of Liberal success or because they've got a leader who is strongly differentiated, a la sort of Tim Fischer from the Liberals. And they don't have either of those things now. They've got this very tarnished leader. He's come back. He's different, but, you know, people are very sceptical about him. They don't really represent anything substantial, which is why they're making so much noise about so little in reality right now. And they are under threat from the shooters and fishers and farmers or whatever they're called now on the right, and from the fact that you've got a lot of independence movement sort of MPs in waiting sort of contesting that sort of space of disaffected conservative voters, and I think it's a real problem for them.
I think it would be very exciting if we had a Prime Minister who called the Nats bluff, because where the hell can the Nats go anyway? But thanks, Laura. Laura Tingle, 7:30's chief political correspondent and our regular guest on Mondays for as long as I can remember, and hopefully far into the future.